Welcome to First Moves. In today's episode, we'll be talking to Stijn Willemsen, founder of Disorder Apparel. We'll be talking about how Stijn uses personal motivation to build Disorder into a company that has sold in 17 different countries around the world. We'll also be talking about how Stijn built the right team for Disorder and how he used vulnerability as one of his strengths in the company. If you want to learn how to build the right foundation for your startup, please stay tuned for this episode. We hope you enjoy. Welcome, Stijn, to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Many of the listeners know you as being the co-host of First Moves, but today you're sitting in the hot seat sharing your experience with Disorder.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to share the story from the other side. So I'm
definitely
curious.
I think a lot of people are interested in hearing it as well.
I guess we'll see.
Could you maybe share a little bit about what Disorder is?
Sure. So Disorder is a clothing brand. And we use clothing as a canvas to start conversations around mental health. So clothing is, well, basically a canvas in and of itself that allows people to express themselves. And so through different text designs or graphics, we can basically make it easier for people to make a statement and also start conversations with people in their environment, be it friends, families, strangers, what have you. And then with that, we're working towards kind of the larger goal of maybe making the world a bit more human and breaking the stigma that keeps a lot of people silent, that keeps a lot of people in a dark place, and that leads to, in some cases, very unfortunate ends as well.
What was your personal motivation to start this a couple of years ago?
Well, I think the main elements that play into it are kind of, maybe the first one is a place of pain, and then the second one is partially also how I was raised. So starting with the latter first, I moved around a lot as a kid. And something that my parents, I don't know if they explicitly wanted to show it to me, but they showed it to me in any case. They wanted to leave the places that we moved to better than we found them. And so my dad would do that through his work, my mom through her work, whatever that form might take. And I think that left quite a big imprint on me to just try and do that. Every single situation I'm in, I try to leave it better than when I found it. And that paired with kind of a deep pain that I had for a few good years motivated me to start Disorder. So when I was a teenager, some things and like thought patterns and emotions from my past started to really bubble up. And then when I was 18, that kind of reached its climax where I was having anxiety attacks every single day. I was depressed for like two and a half years, really struggled with depersonalization and derealization disorder, so dissociation. I also lost one of my childhood best friends to suicide, amongst other difficult things that happened during that time. And so when I was in that space, I saw that when I would go to a house party and talk to people or a friend or whatever, and they'd ask me how I was doing, I'd be relatively open about it. And in return, when I was open to it, I'd kind of open a door for them to talk about the things that maybe they were going through. And in some cases, these were friends who I'd known for years who were going through things, you know, for years, but only at that point did it come to the surface. And I found that quite unfortunate. So at this time I thought, well, there's so many people going through this. I think we just need to start more of these conversations. How can I start these conversations? And by asking myself that question, I started to think about it. And at one point I just thought, well, I'm going to wear my heart on my sleeve. I'm just going to be open myself. That's worked so far. I thought, wait, crap, sleeve, clothing, that could work. And so, I mean, the video listeners will see there's a heart on my sleeve. And it's a statement that I'm wearing on my shirt because it's the starting point for Disorder, and it's the message that we've had kind of since day one, and it's brought us to where we are today.
It's very interesting to see that you take such a personal subject to you and kind of bring it out into the real world, trying to help other people as well. What is your vision and mission now for Disorder?
So at the beginning, it was like four things at once, because we wanted to break the stigma. We wanted to start conversations. We wanted to kind of, you know, build a community. And we wanted to empower people who were struggling. So it was a lot of things at once. And over the years, that slowly kind of sharpened itself to starting conversations. That's really it. That's all we kind of focus on, because we think that with the clothes, we can just simply plant seeds for conversations. And beyond that, we're not too fussed with the other parts anymore. We kind of see those things as a result of starting conversations, as that's also kind of step one. And that's where we put our attention now. So that's what we've been working towards. We've, you know, brought this back to our designs. I had the design team sit down and ask them, okay, how can clothes reach and like actually work towards our mission? And so they came up with different ways they could do that. And then we started designing our collections that way. And those collections went better. And it goes down to how we built, you know, even the website, newsletters we've had, things like this. It comes down to everything. And so now it's just kind of living that mission and doing more of it. Yeah.
So as you already know from having your companies, entrepreneurship often requires a lot of resilience and a very good support system around you to talk about the stuff that's going on with the up and downs within the company. How have you approached seeking support and building a community? And how has that changed since you started your business?
Well, I think there's different levels to building a community. Especially when it comes to having a company, you have the community inside the business, so the team. That has always been very important to me. From kind of the day that I settled that I wanted to do this, I never thought I would do it alone. Not only because I suck at drawing and could never make clothes, but because I knew it was very important to include people who had different perspectives than mine so that we could test things and work towards something that was actually better. It's like the old adage, you know, if you want to go far, you go with other people. If you want to go fast, you go alone. I wanted to go far. So that is like community level number one, the team. Then I think beyond that, you have kind of your close friends and family. So I'd already learned through the experiences I had with my own mental health how important that support system was. And I'm nowhere near perfect at it yet. I still really suck at it. But seeing the value that friends have to play and that your family can play, I think that's super valuable. So that's another level of support. And then I think there's like a third one, which is like, they're also your friends usually, but they are also founders, or they know what it's like to be in a position where you're generally quite young, yet you feel like you have a lot of weight on your shoulders. So it's talking to people who have their own companies as well, or their own projects, or who, and I don't mean to like pump it up as like it's better than what other people do, but who kind of stick out their neck a bit and have maybe some skin in the game. I think talking to those people also really helps, because we're all going through similar issues, and only when we talk can we actually see that that's the case, and then we can work towards solutions together and learn from one another. So I think for me, those are kind of three key levels, and then anything beyond that is usually more official. So that could be the university, that could be other institutions that support you, like partners of the company. That, of course, is like maybe more of a stakeholder community than anything else, and not per se for me personally, but more for the business.
So I've known you for some years now, and when we talk to each other, we kind of share quite a bit about the companies we have, even on a financial plan, really like, oh, this is my issue right now. Have you had that before? How do you deal with this?
Yep.
Is there different levels of information that you share with different friend groups or with your family?
I wouldn't say different levels of information. I would say different kinds. And even the frame I use to talk about the information can change. If it's the team, I will always use a more optimistic frame. Always be, okay, this might be crap, but we're here to make it better or to solve the issue or whatever it might be. If it's another founder like you, I might not be as positive, but we're still, I think, solution-oriented, right? Because also I want to gauge with other people who are in the same situation or similar situations how they think about it. When it comes to like friends and family, there I think it's far more simply the emotional side, feeling heard and kind of finding some peace in the difficult things, and also like zooming out, like realizing it's not everything. It's, you know, if the company ends tomorrow, that's unfortunate and that would suck. But at the same time, there are things that are more important. So talking with friends and family also helps me see that. Yeah.
And in building this community now that you have with the support around, what role has the university played in building this community?
So it goes back to like day, well, not one, but very early on. I reached out to the Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation here at the university. And it was still during the pandemic. So hopped on a Zoom call and talked to Roy. And that was quite helpful because he asked us tough questions that we hadn't thought about, because everybody who was on the team, we hadn't started a business before. And so when it came to how do we allocate shares, how do we set a mission statement that isn't just like a piece of paper on the wall that nobody looks at, how is it something that we actually live? How do we find customers? Will people buy your products? All those kinds of questions. Of course, we had somewhat thought about them, but being asked the right questions about those things really helped. And that was kind of the starting point of the relationship to the university. Beyond that, on the day that we launched, so November 1st, 2021, I was able to talk at the opening keynote of the Wellbeing Week. I didn't do the keynote. I did a few years later, which is a nice personal victory for me. But I was able to kind of go on stage after the keynote had finished and pitch what we'd done. And that for sure brought in some customers on the first day as well, which was a nice win. And I think the biggest support from the uni we've gotten so far is getting our own office space, like having that sponsored to us basically by the university, kind of during the academic year of, what, 2022 to 2023. And that was a really big help because I would have gone insane working from home and the library and cafes if I didn't have an office to go to, nor places to meet with partners or the team. Yeah, that would have been an issue. So I think that's really the biggest support we've gotten. Yeah.
Yeah, that's also that kind of post-COVID now that everyone is still, we could do things online, but it's much nicer to start being in person now. And even during COVID, it was nice to have an office space that you could go to where there's not that many people around.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, COVID was largely over when the office space started. But indeed, having those kinds of conversations, like it changes the game if you're in person. Because I think you pick up on the smaller signals. And in business, I think it's not true and maybe not a healthy perspective always, but there is a very fine line between you as a person and you as a business. And so being able to see how someone reacts emotionally to a statement or to a question can give you insights as to where they are or where they aren't. And I think if Roy had that input, he might have been able to even ask better questions. And I could have maybe sensed things on his side as well. And that is not only that conversation, but I think to all conversations at large.
So you've been very open in the past and also right now about your own mental health journey and what you've been through. And you've spoken about this publicly as well as a keynote speaker at the different events. Has this impacted your brand's authenticity and how you have relationship with your customers?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think the thing is that what you want as an organization is to have alignment with your values. And so if we're here to start conversations around mental health, to show that you can go through difficult times, that it's a human thing, and it's not per se about those things happening, but rather the fact that you can learn and grow from them, and that it can be crap, but that there's still stuff on the other side as well. Like by bringing all of that to light, that is basically what our mission is. And so if you can't do that yourself as the founder of an organization that does that, I think that undermines the very existence of the organization. So for me, that more public-facing vulnerability, I think it's important to have that, at least if that's what your company stands for. So it's definitely been a help for us, and I think that's what's gotten us in many doors, what has started many conversations that then led to partnerships. I think it's, yeah, absolutely foundational.
So do you believe that the future of a good brand building lays in telling these kind of personal stories and showing your own vulnerability a bit as well?
Well, I think it depends on context, right? You can have the founder, like me, telling a story, and I think that can help in certain settings. But at the same time, I think if you're a huge insurance company who has gone through many CEOs or leadership teams or whatever, and they were not the ones to start, and they maybe didn't have a personal pain related to this, but just their career path put them there, then I think that disconnect, as you know, as long as it doesn't go superficial in the storytelling, then it's fine, but it might not be the best place to do it either. Maybe it's interesting to then bring the same kind of storytelling on a different level from customers or other employees who have a personal connection to what the company does. I think it's just context.
So a lot of people actually view vulnerability as a risk, especially in business. Can you maybe share a moment where being vulnerable actually really helped you and another time where it maybe didn't help you so much as you thought it was going to help you?
I mean, I think risks are risks and you need to be calculated with them and you need to take them intelligently. And so there's definitely. Been, yeah. I think there's been definitely cases where I have not been intelligent with it. But I think the underlying philosophy and being aligned with that and kind of living the organizational values, that has enabled us to sell in 17 countries. I think if that wasn't there, many of the events, many of the pitches, lots of the content on social media wouldn't have been made. And it wouldn't have gotten us where we are, nor would it have created the understanding of fundamental ideas that we then use to put on clothing, which starts conversations, which spreads the product further through word of mouth. So in that sense, vulnerability has been foundational to our success. When I look at times when it's gotten in the way, I think it depends a lot on the frame that I've used in that scenario. So I was having a conversation with a school to go give workshops there. That's something that we do with Disorder as part of our impact model. We developed these workshops with a psychologist, and I'd done a few variations of a similar workshop, but I wanted to create like basically full packages where I could go into a school and give a training to teachers, to leadership, to students, maybe even to parents, just to kind of touch the whole community. I didn't just want to walk into a school, say some words and walk back out and maybe tear open some wounds while I was there. I really wanted to give like a full package. And I was having a conversation with a school and I wanted to simply test the idea with them. But I was still very early on in the development of the idea, so I didn't know exactly what I wanted. I just had some buzzwords and ideas and some loose concepts in my mind. And I just wanted to gain their perspective to make sure it's something that they were interested in and wanted and to develop the idea further. And started a call, hopped on, and I wasn't very clear with the intention. I didn't say, I want to learn, I want to talk about this, but I'm not totally sure where I am and I'd like to bounce back and forth ideas to create something that we can both be very happy with and that can help your students and can also help my development process, because I'd worked with the school before. But I didn't do that. And instead, I just hopped on the call and had a few very generic questions. And then the questions that the person on the other side asked me, I didn't really have good answers for them because I wasn't clear on what I wanted to get. And so then I just said, I have no clue. Yeah, sorry, I'm not quite sure. And we just kind of were too, I was an idiot in the call. And it led to, I think, reduced trust maybe, and the possibility of, you know, a big workshop package, which can bring in a lot of cash as well. So yeah, like I said, it depends on the frame a lot. And I think if you're smart with it, it can help you forward. Even in that scenario, if I just said it differently, it would have really helped, but, it can also screw you over if you're not smart with it.
Do you think that the way you frame these kind of things, also just for general people, is it something you learn or is it something that you kind of just have a talent for doing? Or do you think you can actually teach it to people as well?
I mean, you can absolutely learn it. It's not like a God-given gift. I think you might be better at it or worse at it when you start. sure that that's anything. But learning what is smart to say when, that's something that you learn. And you learn it also by failing and falling on your face and saying the wrong things. Now when I hop on calls and I'm not quite sure what I want to do, but I want to use somebody's perspective or a potential client's perspective on something. And potential client meaning, you know, they're in the same demographic, not per se that I'd immediately want to sell it to them. When I bounce around ideas with them, now I know how to tackle that issue better than I did before. And so to other people on the outside, it might be like, wow, this kid's like talented at it. But I've had hundreds of these conversations and fallen on my face and been on the other side of the table sweating or walked out and cursing at myself. But that's part of it. And I've had workshops that absolutely flopped and went horrible. And it was, I've had a few of those experiences. But then if you reflect on it and you ask the people in the room as well, why do you think this went wrong? And you're able to be vulnerable and maybe even coached in that moment, you're going to learn and you're going to get better.
So you're a company advocating for mental health, which means that a lot of your team is also into that way of helping people that through the clothing that have mental health problems. How do you navigate or create a balance between personal vulnerability and then also professional boundaries when you communicate with your team?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because it's something that we've struggled with. When you look at how you build trust inside teams, there's different ways to do it. So there's like predictive-based trust, which is I trust this person because I understand to a certain degree how they will react to something happening. And so you trust them because you know what they act like and how they behave. But there's a more fundamental and valuable version of trust, which is vulnerability-based trust, where you understand the other person. Not just predict, but you can understand them better. And so having that added level of humanity in my eyes is a huge win. And that's something that we built quite strongly onto the team, in my perspective. Not always pure. Sometimes it went too far and sometimes it didn't go well. And there was breaking of trust and things like this that happens. And you learn from that. But in those cases, generally that was very useful. I think where I had difficulty is that a lot of, you know, the team was on a voluntary basis because, you know, we were students, especially starting out. And it's not like I had the cash to pay people, nor that we had the cash flow to intelligently pay people and not screw ourselves over for the coming months. So being on a voluntary basis, you have a whole host of issues that can come with that, because you're paying your debt somehow. But what that led to is that with some empathy and maybe a lack of clear boundaries and being too friendly or too vulnerable with one another, sometimes meetings would turn into sharing circles and we would lose focus of what we're actually working towards. And sometimes life gets in the way, and it's important to bring that up when it gets in the way of a company being able to do its thing and having those difficult conversations. But sometimes it really doesn't matter, and it's not the time and place to share those things. And that needs to be reserved for a meeting afterwards, or a one-on-one, or with friends or family. And I think that the difficulty when you're doing that is that you lack the ability to put those boundaries there. And that's what we did, and we ran into issues.
Do you think that also these kind of things happen and maybe subconsciously you allowed it to happen because you feel like you owe these people something as well because they work for you on a voluntary basis?
Absolutely. Like if someone came a few minutes late to a meeting, I am someone who's a stickler for we say we start at one, we're basically ready to go at one. Like if you show up 10 minutes later, I won't be very pleased. And the thing is that when people are doing work for you for free and they're putting their blood, sweat, and tears into a project that they might even, you know, not have equity in, there's no financial rewards, it's just kind of like a passion project to them, of course you're going to be like, well, crap, you know, I want the standards to be raised, but I don't have the money to pay them to be able to maybe justify saying certain things or having certain expectations. And I think that led to some friction in the team. And not per se like heavy conflict or anything like this, but just trying to wrap our heads around these situations because they understood that it's still being late. But, you know, if you're not being paid, then there needs to be some dampening of expectations at the same time. And there were still some disagreements with some team members about these kinds of things. And I think now we found a pretty good place where we can get along and still operate within the constraints of the business.
So for someone starting out right now and is currently building your team, what advice would you give to them to make sure that you kind of keep a straight path from the beginning?
So especially if you're a student and you don't have a lot of money, hire people based off of attitude and values and not skills, or take people on the team. Because if you can align on your values and you can align in your attitude towards the work and you have similar standards, similar ways of thinking around certain decisions, that will make your life so much easier, especially because they probably don't have that much working experience. So the skills that they would need to succeed at their job are probably something that they would need to learn in the first place. But if you're learning that on a different set of, you know, values or on a different attitude, that's not useful. They might not even have the attitude to learn about those things, right? So I think that's where your selection should be focused, because people will learn the skills. But learning values is a very different story.
And how would you go about finding team members just based on their values?
This is a difficult question to answer because a 30-minute, 1 hour, whatever interview is not going to be enough. And so I was in the lucky position where when Disorder started out, I was joined by two friends. One of them is still my co-founder to this day, and the other was there to just kind of help me figure out the idea in the early days. And I had picked these people because I knew them for a longer period of time. And of course, mixing friends and business can be dangerous, but I had a deep level of trust and I knew that we could probably work things out. And so they were not per se experts at what we wanted to do. My co-founder, Antonia, she had zero social media marketing experience, but I knew that she cared about the topics I cared about in the same way, where it wasn't too harsh, but it wasn't too soft. And it was kind of like a nice middle ground, at least looking at mental health, for example. But she also understood the fashion world a lot better than I did. And she knew how clothing can change the way that you feel, kind of with that knowledge. And so with these attitudes and values of like, these are the things I care about, I knew I could build on that further. So knowing people beforehand makes a big difference. And I think if you don't know people yet and you need to expand your circle, it might be a little bit of an awkward answer, but also just kind of, I wouldn't say overly trust your gut, but you want to make sure you have a click with the person, because usually that click means that there's some kind of alignment in terms of values. And you can also meet with them in a not so normal scenario. Go to, you know, an arcade and meet them there and ask them questions while they're playing games, because they're making decisions, they're taking actions, they're working towards goals. And it might be with a game on a computer screen or shooting basketballs and hoops, but you can see how they react to failure, to losing, to winning, to making decisions, and how they interact with staff. Are they kind or not, or compassionate or not? How much respect do they give you? Not that they need to bow down to you, but do they immediately treat you horribly as well if you lose and you know, call you names or whatever? I doubt that would happen, but sometimes that could come up in a scenario like this. So I think these unconventional ways of meeting people, that's something that I want to definitely bring forward, because I think it's extremely useful rather than just asking questions about someone's CV.
Did you ever think when you started off with Antonia, who was your friend beforehand, that there was a certain risk as well involved with this, because you knew her as a friend, but you didn't know what would happen once there's money involved? Mm. And how would you mitigate this risk and tell others maybe that are in the same situation saying, I would actually really like to start a company with this person, but it's my idea, And I'm scared at some point that I know them as a friend now, but maybe later on, I don't know what's going to happen if we get into, we have equity and one of us leaves and we have to battle out with money. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to battle. I don't know if it's going to be fine. How do you deal with that in the beginning?
I think it's setting up rules of engagement and having a lot of clarity as to how you go about business. How many hours do you put in per week? What's your level of commitment? What are we working towards? Like, having all of that very clear helps. And then having rules of, if we disagree, what happens then? If it's two people, that's a very difficult situation, especially if it's a 50-50 balance. Even if it's like a 51-49, you know, on paper, or, you know, even a 90-10, let's say, the person who's at 10% might always feel like their opinion is overlooked or overridden, which might build resentment and break trust and do all those kinds of things. So any two-person scenario, I think, is also very difficult, but at least setting up how do we make decisions and what happens if we have a falling out. Having those things clear makes a big difference, because then you're not in the moment deciding with your ego or with the other person's ego how to continue. It's, no, we said this before based on logic and the expectations we had set, and so this is how we will follow through. And if things have drastically changed, maybe that's worth putting in, but then maybe it's also like a time to put in a lawyer, you know, if it's that drastic. So yeah, I think you go a long way with those few things already.
Yeah, so just have honest conversations in the beginning, and they might be tough, but just go for it. It's better to do it now than later on and getting lawyers involved, and maybe you lose a friend over that.
Yeah, I mean, if you build a stronger foundation, your skyscraper can be taller, right? So if you build something super high, but it crumbles within, you know, a year or 2 years, then you obviously didn't work out fundamental things either at the start, but it's also a continuing conversation. It's not something that just... it's done and dusted once you've had it once. It's something that, at least the disorder, I wanted to have on a far more regular basis. And really, I think a lot of those like fundamental business things, they get forgotten because they're just buzzwords. Like performance reviews, you know, they've turned into not per se performance reviews, but at the core, all they're about is making clear to someone what the expectations are of their role, how they're living up to it. If not, how they could, and if they are still areas of improvement, or why they're living up to it and what that could turn into later. And I think that by not even making those things clear, but just calling it a performance review and not by defining terms, you get screwed over. And that, you know, you need to define terms, make it clear, repeat it over and over and over and over again so that we're on the same page. Otherwise, you slowly start to crack away at either the foundation or you start building things differently. And when that happens, you put yourself, your team, and the company, and other stakeholders who are involved at risk of something going very wrong.
So to bring it back to this order again, what are the challenges that you have run into using your brand as a mental health advocacy?
So I think mental health is very much a buzzword, right? So, I mean, I remember when I was starting, people were like, oh, so you're just coming up for people who have anxiety or depression or schizophrenia, or... even people were asking like people with Down syndrome, which is not at all like a mental health issue, right? So, and even then, mental health issues, we weren't only focused on issues, but just mental health as a whole, because it's, we talk so much about physical health and the importance of it, but you know, if suicide rates are going up like crazy, anxiety rates are going up like crazy, depression is going up like crazy, and we don't know how to talk about it, it's only going to make it worse, and there's going to be big consequences to it. And that's the issue side of the conversation. But likewise, what about having resilience and compassion and the ability to enjoy things and have beautiful friendships and relationships? That's another side of mental health. And by kind of the goal of these, you know, conversations that we were starting were to make people feel heard, but also to kind of plant some seeds for people to define terms, because I think people have like an internal compass where they can define these things or not. And so I think that's part of the starting conversation, so that people could actually see what are we talking about, because we had those things inside of disorder, for example. That's the big issue, was that the terms were not defined, and you could walk into a room and say, oh, we want to start conversations around mental health. People would have their own definition of mental health and we would have ours. And they would immediately look at us and think, well, that's absolutely like who needs shirts about I have schizophrenia and that's an issue. I mean, some people might want to wear that, but that's not what we were solving for. What we were working towards was we just want to start conversations around how people feel, because when the pandemic was there, 85% of Dutch students were struggling with their mental health, but nobody was really talking about it. Yet a lot of people were feeling pretty bad. And I think if we can't even talk about that, we can't solve the problem, right? And so, yeah, I think that is maybe the biggest obstacle we faced. Beyond that, I think it's all the normal business stuff, like working capital, branding, marketing. Yeah.
You mentioned the increasing rates of anxiety and depression. Mm. So just a quick in-between question here. Do you believe that COVID actually contributed to the success of this order?
Yeah, well, I think we kind of rode a bit of a wave of mental health being talked about more. And there was a big difference in terms of the raised eyebrows we got in the early days versus now. I mean, now we also have something to show for it. And as soon as you tell people some stats of the things we've done, it's like, ah, okay, there's something there. But yeah, I mean, when you look at like the mental health crisis and how that's unfolding, that really already kind of started to pick up like early 2010s. And it's really, social media is a huge contributor, but it's also, you know, political polarization and rapid change and economic issues and all those kinds of things conflating together with, I don't know if it's societal expectations or what exactly, you know, it's kind of 10,000 things at once. Yeah, because it's becoming a bigger issue and COVID showed it's a bigger issue. It has made it easier, but at the same time, it's exactly where we exist. So, yeah.
What trends do you see shaping the future of social entrepreneurship, specifically in relation to mental health?
Mental health, I'm not so sure about. I think really it's still such a new issue in some ways. I mean, it's been there since the dawn of time, but like the way that it's happening now and unfolding now, it's so new that I think basically any initiative you see around it starts to realize it's about starting conversations. There's different Instagram pages. There's also other clothing brands that have popped up in the meantime. Some have failed. Some have stuck around. Charity events, like different kinds of things. And really, they're all zeroing on starting conversations. And I think that comes down to, like I said before, the terms not being defined. When it comes to social entrepreneurship, I think it's on a big rise, especially as, at least here in the EU, a lot of things are being backed by regulation as well. So, you know, companies need to focus more on having a positive impact on the world. And I think a lot of people look at business as if it's diametrically opposed to having a positive impact. But I think all that business does is solve problems and finds a way to monetize them and, you know, fill certain niches. But I think if the power of business is uniting people and solving problems and making money off of them, that doesn't mean that the problems are only there to be solved for money. They can also be solved for being solved and, coincidentally, also nicely earning money. So I think with people realizing that, with, you know, companies like Tony Schiacoloni, I mean, there's some examples from the US, like Whole Foods was that, you know, a few years ago, but more and more of those changes, I think that will, yeah, it's going to continue to happen, and only more so, I think.
What advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs who want to make a social impact through their business?
So I wrote my bachelor thesis about disorder, and I think, God, that was in 2022. And even now, I'm still understanding that to a greater depth with other work I'm doing for a new company I have and other things I'm just curious about in the world of business. And the main thing about socially oriented enterprise is that you have two missions. You have the mission of making money because you're a business and you need capital and you need to be, you know, net positive at the end of the day, because otherwise you're running into continuity issues, etc. Just that your model works, right? And then on the other side, you want to have that impact. And so realizing that you have those two competing kind of logics of running a business, it can cause a lot of issues. So at Disorder, for example, we started off with a 50% charity donation to our partner, Mental Health Europe. 50% net profit, let me be clear. And so after, I think, writing my thesis relatively quickly, I realized 50% is way too much because we're a business that really needs working capital. So then the issue is that if I want to grow the impact, I also need to grow the business. But to grow the business, I need working capital to invest in marketing, in, you know, having enough cash for stock, etc. And so giving away all that money for impact is great, but it screws our ability for the long term. So then I cut that down to 20% net profit, freed up some cash, and it allowed us to grow. But at the same time, you could argue, well, that has less impact. Yeah, maybe now, but not over the long run. But if you take that to its extreme and you're continuously delaying when you create impact, it might never come. So you kind of want to find ways where you can really align these things and find a model that when you make money, you make impact. And if you can align those things perfectly, that's great. Like if you're literally, to keep it around mental health, and it's a horrible example, but if you keep it around mental health, you have a therapist who makes a living, maybe has a practice and keeps other people employed, and they're directly solving problems and helping these people if they're good at their job. But that is that's a beautiful thing, for example, right? People can make a living helping other people. But you can do the same in business on far higher scales. And I think that is so untapped and something that is just really starting, that I think that is where a big change will happen. But to do that, you need clarity and you need alignment between impact and money.
So we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guest, you already know this, yeah, to bring an object that has a personal meaning to them. What did you bring for us today?
So I brought a Lego car. Ever since the age of 8, I've been into cars. I'm a nerd when it comes to it. Very stereotypical of a dude, I guess. The passion runs deep. And at the same time, I also love Lego because I love building things. And for me, I bought this specific car when I had just finished a full week of workshops at my old high school. And I think in total, there was something like 160 students or people that I spoke to that week, including teachers and other people. And for me, that was really a moment when I realized that the kid I was, especially at that school, walking around with my own problems, who could now a few years later come back and use what I had learned to help others and do that in a way where I could also earn money doing it, it was like, well, crap, I've kind of cracked a nut, at least, you know, started to. And I've started to make good progress. And for me, I have a hard time giving myself props because I'm still very much focused on what I could improve or do better or where I'm lacking. And so for me, this little Lego car, to me, it represents a little nod to myself of, you can do it. You're doing it. And if you keep going, you will be better. Because it was one of the first times that I felt that way, truly. And so for me, that's super important. And so I have this above my bed and I look at it every day. Of course, not as deeply or as intensely or as philosophically as I'm doing now, maybe. But for that reason, it holds a special place in my heart. And I look forward to more Lego cars or cars in the future. I guess we'll see.
Thank you for joining us as a guest today.
I mean, yeah, thanks for having me on. It was fun. It's cool to be in the hot seat. Interesting to share your story from this side. And a lot to learn in different ways as well. So thank you for having me.
And thank you for sharing.